listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
It's just a very dangerous development. They say that our mass media interfered, but it is not so.
That was Russia's President Vladimir Putin at a press conference at the APEC summit in Da Nang, Vietnam this past weekend. He was referring to the recent demand by the U.S. Justice Department that the Russian media outlet RT register as a foreign agent.
Mass media, they just express the point of view, they give information, they give opinions. You can argue about that, but you should not be closing or banning or creating the condition which prevents some mass media from working at all. You should produce your point. You should make your case. But no, they decided to ban and to impose sanctions.
The demand was made under the U.S. Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA, passed in 1938, targeting Nazi Germany. Washington had threatened to freeze RT's assets if it failed to comply. RT's editor-in-chief, Margarita Simonian, said the broadcaster would go to court to prove that the demand violated U.S. law. However, on Monday, she said, between legal action and registration, we chose the latter. The measures targeting RT have drawn criticism not only in Russia and elsewhere around the world, but also right here in the U.S., last year's vice presidential candidate for the Green Party, Ajamu Baraka, slammed the move as outrageous. He noted that singling out RT, the only media organization on the FARA list, not only implies that it is somehow different from BBC and Deutsche Welle and other state-funded media, but also somehow qualitatively different from U.S. corporate-owned media. Baraka said that the U.S. mainstream media, including CNN, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, should be required to register as agents of capitalism. The Washington Post is owned by Amazon billionaire Jeff Bezos, the New York Times by the Oaks-Sulzberger family, and CNN by the multinational giant corporation Time Warner. For more on that, we spoke with Peter Lavelle, who's an American living in Moscow, who hosts RT's flagship program, Crosstalk. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Sunday. Well, Peter, let's see. We had the Hollywood 10 back in the early 1950s. It looks like they're traveling down the same road. Of course, we have, you know, a new media environment, new technologies, new methodology of communicating, much more intensive state control of the media in terms of the physical apparatus, like the internet being stored in Utah or whatever. So how does it look? You know, you're an American who produces a TV show in Moscow for a Russian new international, you know, a Russian-owned international news agency. What does it look like to you?
Well, I think this is truly, truly tragic. And in my opinion, and I don't speak for RT management, but in my opinion, RT is being turned into a test. And it's a test that no one will protect RT's right of speech. I don't see the American Civil Liberties Union. You know, they let Nazis march in Stokely, Illinois.
But I remember
that. I haven't heard a peep from them to stand up for freedom of expression from foreign broadcasters. And I look at it, and I think you look at it, as a foreign broadcaster. Well, number one, American powers that be do not like it when Americans hear foreign broadcasters, up and in including BBC. You don't get BBC really very much in the U.S., okay? Not to speak of Press TV or Al Jazeera, you know, they sold their soul. So they had some kind of presence, but then no one watched it because they were emulating CNN.
Right.
So I think that RT is a test, and then it's going to be, let me back up. Look how complicit that Twitter and YouTube and Google in all of this. And you know what? When RT, whatever its fate is, and I'm not optimistic in my opinion in the U.S., then they're going to take on social media. The powers that be and legacy media find this environment abhorrent. They can't make any money, number one, and they can't control the narrative, number two. That's their worst nightmare. And I truly believe they're going to start trying to claw it back. And I'm thinking of websites like 21st Century, 21st Century News.com, Moon of Alabama, to some degree, the American Conservative, Oons.com, and we could go on and on. Consortium News. These are where I get the truth as I understand it. And this attack on RT is unprecedented. It is using the FARA Act has never been used against a media outlet. And so that they're breaking precedent there. And I don't even think that they will follow the law. I will be so bold to say, look, they illegally took over the Russian compound in San Francisco, illegally under international law and under domestic law. Not a peep from anyone. No one said what is right and what is legal. And I'll leave off on this. I haven't seen in any way, shape, or form that RT has broken any laws in the United States.
I don't think anyone's even accused them of that.
Any FEC laws have been broken. I'm sorry, FCC laws have been broken at all. I'd like to know what they are. And I hear that RT is called a propagandist, and I'm a propagandist. Well, call RT and call me on it. Give me one example. One. And all of the stuff, all of the nonsense that is said about RT, written about RT, no one ever mentions examples. Never. It's astounding to me.
Yeah, they don't, you know, so, they don't do that in
there's a conspiracy without a crime here.
Yeah, that's right.
A conspiracy without a crime.
That's right. Well, first of all, you mentioned the silence from such as the ACLU. Let's go back to the early 1950s. You know, I live in Ossining, New York, and in Ossining, New York, there was a diner called the Highland Diner for many years, owned by the family of a gentleman named Corliss Lamont. Corliss Lamont was a board member of the ACLU who resigned because the ACLU would not represent defendants who were brought up under what was called the Smith Act until the appellate stage, because they did not want their identity to be confused with communists. And so they let communists, that was anyone that was accused of being a communist, go through trial, be in prison, all of that, without lifting a finger or raising a voice until it was time to file maybe an amicus curiae brief on a particular point of law at the appellate stage. So, you know, there's a history of some of these big groups that claim to be defenders of human rights and civil rights sitting on their hands when there's actually a fight that matters. And you talk about state media or propaganda. Okay, we've got BBC here, now, which is on cable. It's on my, if I go upstairs on my cable set, on basic cable, I have BBC, I have I-24, which is an Israeli TV channel, and there's an Indian state TV channel. These are all state and or in Israel, for example, like the United States, it's difficult to parse what's private and what state because you have the same people.
I think it's important. I think the really the right appellation is funded.
Right.
Okay. Because let me explain to our listeners here, working at RT for about 12 years now, I have never been to an editorial meeting.
Right.
I don't even know if they exist.
Right.
Okay. I'm in the programming department. I'm not in the news department. I've never been to an editorial meeting about, you know, what our message is, like Zucker over at CNN. You know, I mean, that was leaked a few days ago, go after Donna Brazile.
Right.
I mean, I guess that's what they do at CNN. I've never been to an editorial meeting where we get talking points. My hand on a stack of Bibles has never happened to me.
Yeah, they point a camera at you and you start, just go for it. I know that, but that's what we do.
You know me well enough. I just, first thing that comes in my mind.
Right.
So I think it's better to say state funded. And for our listeners to understand, the vast majority of television all around the world has some kind of government funding.
Right.
The vast majority of broadcasts around the world. Americans are so they're so inward looking that maybe, yes, a lot of broadcasters in the United States are private, but that's an anomaly in the world.
And let's also talk about what that, let's talk about what that means, by the way, too. Here in the United States, you have PBS and NPR. Now, they are not publicly funded anymore. They get all kinds of money from, we call NPR National Petroleum Radio because they get money from ExxonMobil and all these other places. And the same with PBS. But, you know, where you have or had public housing, public water supplies, public utilities, you had public funded media. And that's what government, quote unquote, owned media or government funded media is the government says, here, we're funding a TV station. We bought the equipment. We hired some staff. Go make television. Now, what are the rules that govern the operation of it? That's the devil in the details, and that varies from place to place, whether it's government or corporate owned. Now, where it's government owned, you usually have some sort of access restrictions that operate in favor of the public, like they used to have here with an equal time rule, for example, things like that. And when it's privately owned, they can do anything they want in the name of freedom of speech. They own it. They can say what they want. They can run it how they want. So the idea that government-funded media is a propaganda mill for the government as opposed to private media, meaning corporate media, meaning ExxonMobil and Chase and all that stuff, somehow is more free speech is ridiculous.
Well, public and private, even that distinction is really nonsensical or not meaningful anymore because we have the example of Fox News. Now, Fox News is obviously ideologically driven, and it's and look at MSNBC. I have a respect for both because they show their colors to everyone. Okay, one's very very progressive left, and one's very conservative. Okay, that is fine. You know what you're going to get. CNN is I try to play this game with everyone that they're actually the fair and balanced one. No, they're very much off to the left. But, you know, if you look at RT, we're even the distinctions of left and right are important because RT America is very left-wing progressive. And I know the powers that be don't like that, okay? I mean, progressives are being hunted. It's hunting season for progressives in the United States, particularly in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And then if you go to RT International, if you look at the programs, I'm the only one that has any kind of where you can clearly identify an ideological point of view, and I'm quite conservative on most issues. But if you look at the totality in the English language of RT, it's a majority left progressive. I mean, during the campaign, I called RT America, you know, Bernie Bros.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
It was almost without exception. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, what people are, what they think they know about RT, I mean, I have to, in all honesty, have to wonder all of my critics personally and critics of RT, have they ever watched the channel?
Yeah.
Because I don't understand what they're talking about. It's talking about another place that I don't work.
You know, some not only that, when they did the analysis or whatever the hell that document was that the CIA and
the January one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When they, you know, here's the blueprint for how the Russians stole the election or whatever, then the chapter under RT, it was clear that they haven't watched in like 5 years because they had at the heart of the matter Abby Martin, who hadn't been with the station for 2-3 years at that point, and a couple of others that I never watched myself. Crosstalk, not there. The most watched program on RT, from looking at the hits on YouTube. If I were going to challenge, and now people have been discussing this, CIA or whatever, if I were going to say this is how they influenced the election, the main way, which isn't how it happened, looking at the vote counts, but they let the other candidates debate, which no other media outlet in the United States would do, having the Greens and the Libertarians, and et cetera, do a presidential debate. Now, as it turns out, there was a minuscule vote for them for in the aggregate. So it clearly didn't have any impact on the election. But in terms of the political culture, it gave expression to other voices, which is what alternative media is supposed to do, and which the alternative media, quote-unquote, in the U.S. did not do.
Exactly. And what RT did was pick fill in a niche that people were interested in. I have a lot of very conservative views, but I'm thrilled to talk with progressives because that means there's a debate. Duopoly of American political power.
Right.
I mean, all we see in the airwaves in the United States is it's trivialization of real debate on what really impacts real people every single day. They go into these cultural wars that just chew up all this time and suck all the air out of the room. And, you know, and when somebody talks about fracking, which, you know, that's verboten, you know, and then our team runs something on fracking. And it's like, we're like a thunderbolt. I mean,
yeah.
No, actually, public opinion show that there is concern about fracking. There are many, many Americans. I don't have the number on my fingertips right now, but I think it's almost 2/3 of Americans that would like to have a more balanced field, playing field for other parties. I mean, well, RT is providing a service. It's not. It's following an agenda. It's not creating an agenda.
Right. Well, for example, reporting things that are not getting reported anywhere else. Ajamu Baraka, a vice presidential candidate, also, you know, he is a contributor to one of the most prominent black media outlets in the United States, blackagendareport.com. He's a regular columnist there. He says, tosses into this discussion, CNN should register as an agent of capitalism. And as a matter of fact, I would say, if you were going to be absolutely accurate and to the point, they should register as an agent of the corporations that fund it by looking at their ad revenue. And that, because, hey, you have to declare what we used to have to declare, how much money you put into presidential campaigns for advertising purchases and all this other stuff. Well, if you're absolutely making editorial policy that favors candidates, that frames the damn commercials that are airing, that should also be noted so people can make up their minds about what they're hearing. And that's what he's pointing out.
Well, of course, in a purely theoretical sense, he's correct. Everyone should be forced to show where they're getting their funding from, even if it's a corporate television.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't believe the powers that be really will go down that path because that would be a recognition that they have a monopoly of power and that they do not want any challengers.
Right.
And that's exactly what we are. I mean, I am and you are in our own different ways. And because they have this propensity to break law around the world, this is, I think this is really another tangent that's really important, is that We have forced regime change all around the world illegally with American taxpayer money. Most Americans don't even know it's being done in their name. And now they're taking the same model, the Maidan model of the illegal coup in Kiev in February 2014, and they're applying it at home. They're using Yep. that playbook at home. It's come home, where you have the FBI and other intelligence services that are politicized, that are partisan. You know, Don, when it goes to that point there, it's the end of the republic.
Yeah.
It's the end of the republic.
Yeah.
Because once you go down that path, how do you, if these people are entrenched, they're not going to give up their power. They will find ways to go after you. 10 ways to Sunday. Okay. Mm. And this is the real tragedy right now, because one candidate didn't get elected and everybody wanted that candidate to win. Now you're going to break the entire system. Yeah. This is what's really, really scary. I watch Trump on a regular basis. I'm confused. I laugh. I cry. But it will be over soon.
Right.
Okay? Everybody relax. How many presidents have you been through, Don? How many have I been through?
Yep.
We'll make it.
Yep.
But in their demand and their charge to delegitimize and upturn the 2016 election, they're going to destroy the entire system, and they're destroying the confidence people have in the system. I mean, for an anarchist, this is a wet dream.
Yeah, for sure. You know, you've got so many things that are happening at the same time that this is happening. You've got a record, numbers of people that just have clearly no confidence whatsoever in the institutions anymore. The media polls, in single low double digits in terms of favorability. You know, as they talk about how poorly Trump is polling, they themselves actually poll worse, and they're conducting the polls. Congress, the same, somewhere between 8 and 25%, depending on which poll you see. And this is happening. Those are, the institutional power of things. Your legislature, which is supposed to be the most democratic part of the government. You have the communications, the lifeblood of the republic, so to speak. No one trusts any of that. And then, of course, record unemployment. So the economic system itself, and we've seen the word socialism, whatever it means to the people that are being polled, rising in popularity like it hasn't been since the 1930s in the United States. And yet they're tightening their control over this. I'm watching, there's a movie that was made in April of 2002. There was a coup d'etat that took place in Caracas, as you know, in Venezuela, backed by the United States. And it happened while there happened to be this camera crew inside the presidential palace, who ended up documenting everything with the, presidential palace eye view of this. And you watch what happened since November 8th. It looks exactly the same. Exactly.
Yep. Yep. One thing you said that I get our viewers aware of and crystal clear. Every time the stock market is at record highs, another record high. The stock market has nothing to do with the average person,
right.
Has nothing to do with the average worker. Right. All it tells me is that the financialization of the economy is a full steam ahead.
Continuing apace, yep.
Yeah, continuing the pace here. You're absolutely right. I mean, and also when you become irrational, you hate blindly. When you have blind hatred, you can't think straight. And this is what the media has done. The attacks, incessant attacks on Trump, and many of them are justified.
Right.
But all they're doing, the media, as being a spokesperson for the deep state and the powers that be, what they're doing is that they're energizing Trump's base.
Yeah.
I mean, I took a look at Matt Taibbi's piece right now in Rolling Stone. He's a very astute political watcher. And he points out that public opinion show that nothing has changed in 1 year, that if the election were held again, Trump would probably win again. Now, see, why is this? It's because of the media and the message about this president. It's not about policy. What they're doing is they're replicating what happened 1 year ago, exactly 1 year ago. And that is very bad for the republic, because people are losing, have much faith in politics. Now they're losing all faith in it. Look at this shooting in Las Vegas.
Right.
What the hell happened there?
Right.
We don't know. Then that guy goes on a rampage in that Texas church.
You know what's interesting also? I mean, and this shows that same, you know, lack of confidence in the institutions. There's a shooting here or a shooting there, and as they report it, there are, you know, lots of people, like maybe half the people that you see posting on Facebook or talking at the water cooler or whatever, don't even believe that it happened.
Yep.
It's remarkable that, you know, people now think, well, they never landed on the moon, you know, all these different things. But in other words, even if they saw it in front of them, they wouldn't be sure it wasn't a holograph being projected because they've been so thoroughly lied to.
It's the age of disbelief and anger. That's what I call it.
Yeah.
Disbelief and anger. And it's because the narratives that the media is pushing, people, they look at their everyday life. They look out the window. They communicate with their friends, and they're saying, what in the world are they talking about? They're not talking about what's real.
Right.
And this is very dangerous. And to go back where we started, that's why a lot of people watch RT. And as I put on Facebook, you saw it, I said, no one is forced to watch RT. No one.
That's right. You have...
it's a choice.
That's right. Unprecedented choice now. You have a million gazillion things you can click on the internet, and people are choosing RT because they hear it and it corresponds to the reality that they're living.
Or they actually see a debate about something.
Right.
It's not so clear-cut, everything.
Right.
That's what people like.
I mean, this is one of the things I know going on Crosstalk. No one says, okay, Don, what we really need is somebody to bring out this point of view or that point of view or whatever. Now, I know there's an editorial decision somewhere where somebody's saying, on this topic, he's got some pretty good ideas. I've heard him say things, and that one will be interesting because he believes exactly the opposite, and they're both very good. That person is a hothead. They'd be nice to throw in. You know, I'm sure that kind of decision-making goes on everywhere.
That's my calculus all the time.
Yeah, make it interesting.
I look at the chemistry. I look at the chemistry of the program.
Right. But no one has ever said to me anything other than, well, we're going to be talking about Hillary Clinton and the election, or Steve Bannon, or media, or whatever. That's as much as they get. I go in, do my thing, it's over, everybody says thank you, and that's that. That's how much rigid control that, you know, dark hand of the Kremlin has over what goes out over the airwaves.
And if it were done otherwise, Don, all it would take is a few tweets, and I'd be toast.
That's right. And not only that, who'd want to watch it?
Yeah. So, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I'm very careful about that, because I have to be better than the best to be equal.
That's right. That's right. Yep. All right. Well, you know, meanwhile, in the real world, outside of the media sphere, we had President Trump, he's wrapping up his trip to Asia, two ships passing in the night, you know, sort of virtual encounter and a handshake with President Putin. President Putin saying, look, I didn't rig your election. Trump saying, you know what, looking at him, it looks like he believes that's true. I'm not saying I don't believe our guys, but whatever. Ain't it really the point that we should have peace between us and get some work done that needs to be done? And they're trashing him here again, of course, for that.
Yeah, well, this is what Barack Obama in his waning days wanted to happen. That was the plan, and it's working. Yeah. Historians will look back upon this as just the absolute travesty, a tragedy that didn't have to happen. No matter what Trump says, they're going to spin it to the way they want. I mean, he's not a gifted speaker. I mean, on policy, let's put it that way. I mean, he knows how to get people riled up. But I watched it, the different segments. There's a really good segment on RT. It's a compilation. And I actually felt sorry for the guy, and I actually agreed with him.
Yeah.
Let's be real, folks. I mean, are you going to – you think someone fiddled with your election, you know, a foreign power, that is about to be as naive as you can get.
You know.
All right? do I think that the Russian intelligence services paid a visit to Hillary Clinton's server? Yeah, I think they
probably
did. If the barn door was open, why not?
Well, probably China's did, Japan's did, Germany's did, maybe some guy out in New Jersey did. Yeah, right.
The Macedonians did.
That fat guy in mommy's basement that one of them was talking about during a campaign, they were probably looking too. Why not?
Yeah. So I guess a lesson learned, and Tony Podesta, a good password is, well, not password. So, when it comes to, when I look at the Russian reaction to all of this, and Dima Babich really says, and he's on regular on Crosstalk, is yeah. that the Russians will never tire of attempting diplomacy. It's in their yeah. genetic code.
Yeah.
Okay. They keep trying. And, Mark Sloboda, we both know Will well and your listeners, Mark's got a guy that says he's not, he says you have to give up at a certain point. And that's the kind of a difference between Mark and Dima.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what I see every week.
Yep.
The Russians will keep trying. There are too many important things to do.
Yeah. The stakes are very high.
But at the same time, I think they're realist, and it's to minimize the damage. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, look. What we're hoping is that there's a catastrophe that people look back at, at the end. That the catastrophe is, gee, we could have had, much better economic conditions or whatever, as opposed to, geez, we wouldn't be living under this radioactive smoldering pile if only we didn't miss that opportunity. And I'm hoping that that's not what we're looking at.
But the sad thing, and it would kind of go full circle to our conversation here, is that as the week moves forward, we know that there'll be further attacks on RT, which, of course, will make the Russian side react, which will, of course, be reported in Western media as Russian aggression in the media sphere now.
Right. Yep.
So, you can't win for losing.
That's right. We just got to keep plugging along and doing what we're doing. And you do a great job, and I'm glad you do.
Yeah, but what they'll do is they're just going to make RT and me and you and everybody else more famous. They don't understand the dynamic of how this works.
Absolutely true. That's right. Peter, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, Don. All right. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to World Apart. 3 years after the eruption of violence in Ukraine, the conflict still remains a battle of identity for Kyiv, but not so much for Moscow or Brussels. Increasingly preoccupied by their own internal challenges, both Russia and the European Union would much rather leave Ukraine to its own devices. But can it survive in such a geopolitical limbo? No longer with the East? Not yet with the West. Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Erhard Busek, former Vice Chancellor of Austria. Dr. Busek, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time. Now, I know that you are often asked about the issue of European identity, European values, what it means to be European. And that very interesting philosophical question was right at the center of the, still is at the center of the Ukrainian conflict. 3 years ago, when the protests started gathering at Maidan Square in Kyiv, it was formulated roughly like that. Here is a dark and oppressive Russia, here's a bright and shiny European Union, and innocent, free-loving Ukraine in the middle. Now that Ukraine has been freed from the deadly embrace of Russia, what's next? What's next for Ukraine? What's next for Europe? What's next for Russia?
I think in the perception of the whole conflict, there are a lot of mistakes. I think sometimes it is not understood by the Russians that some things like Crimea and so on are critically seen by international law. But I think there are a lot of mistakes on the Western side. There's a differentiation on the Western side. I think the Americans have a certain perception. That's not mine. And I think it's also not the perception of the whole Europeans. I think there's a tendency to look at the things at white, black.
But where does it come from? Because we are all, we thought at least that we were all adults. Sure, Russia has its challenges with the rule of law, with the building of its institutions, with the authoritarian tendencies in its government. But I think it was really striving throughout the 90s to do something of itself. And all of a sudden, in 2013, we heard that we were those backward, oppressive people who don't give a heck about anything good in this world. Where did it come from?
This is a result of a kind of simplification, which is done on the Western side. I think...
Do you think it was genuine or was it deliberate?
I think it was not delivered. It was it changed never really. I think the perception in the West, the Western European, concerning the changes in Russia, were not going really to the subjects. I think it was for a very long time Russia of Stalin, very primitive, and what was in differentiation was not really seen. I think maybe the perception of the changes, even done by Gorbachev, did not go in the right direction. And afterwards, I think for a lot of people, it was not clear that there was a tremendous change in Russia happening. For sure, you need the time to consume it. It's not happening from one day to the other. And I think everybody has to learn out of their own history.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and if it is coming back to critical confrontation, then the old images are coming up.
But I think at that point of time, nobody really, either on the EU side nor on Russia side, realized that it was actually approaching that very critical confrontational moment. And I want to ask you about the second part of this Manichaean image of the bright and shiny European Union. Where did that image come from? Because the European Union, as successful as it was also having its own struggles. Do you think the clash over Ukraine had anything to do with EU's own internal doubts?
I don't think so. I think, first of all, I have to say quite straight, the knowledge about Ukraine within the European Union is very limited. I think they have no real knowledge. That's one of the advantages of the Austrians. We have a little bit more knowledge. I think a lot of Austrians are wondering that sometimes Russians are saying, Ukraine, this is... nothing else that a part of Russia by history, looking to the baptism in Kiev around 1000 and so on and so on. I think it's not really understood. And so far, that's one of the difficulties.
But I agree with you on that particular point. But I think when Russians say that, and the Russian president often says that, that he personally believes that Russians and Ukrainians came from the same sort of ethnic pool, from the same cultural pool. It's never being argued that Ukraine is no different from Russia. It is never been argued that Ukraine does not have the right to sovereignty, does not have the right to self-determination. Don't you think that perhaps Russians too could have, articulated the ideas a little bit better? Because I could understand how offensive could that be to the Ukrainians.
For sure, it is a learning process. I think the Ukrainians have to learn on themselves. That's one of the difficulties. I remember my first visit of a kind of independent Ukraine. I met my vis-a-vis, the vice president of the Ukrainian government. He was speaking to me in the Russian language. And at a certain moment, when we started our official talks, now I have to switch to the Ukrainian language. For me, it was not the difference because I neither know Russian nor know the Ukrainian language. So far, I think this is mirroring the difficulties they have with themselves in their perception. And also, may I say that this is one of the critiques I'm doing to the Russians. I think the old situations are coming back. I understand Putin and I understand Russia if they are not in favor that NATO is coming directly to the border of Russia. Here I'm fully sharing this opinion and it was a mistake to do so. But on the other side, I think there came back the old impression of confrontation. That's a mistake on the Western side, especially by the Americans, but also of some Western Europeans. I have to say precisely Western Europeans, and also on the other side.
But come on, it's not only the Western Europeans. The Poles, for example, played also quite an active and divisive role.
This is history. I think the confrontation Poland and Russia is a long-lasting one, And I think it's also the question of consummation, what has happened by the end of the Second World War, because Poland was moved 200 kilometers westwards, losing its eastern parts and getting from Germany or Deutsches Reich or whatever you want to say, parts of their country. It is still not yet consumed.
So everybody is essentially acting on their old historical right. And sometimes mythical grievances.
Because it's primitive. I think you have not making any distinctions and you have nothing to consider. I think you are using the old formulas and the old divisions and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's put history aside and let's try to look forward. I've heard you say that what Russia is currently interested in Ukraine is fermenting some sort of a frozen conflict. And I would not actually dispute that, because if you consider all possible alternatives, frozen conflict may not be desirable, but it may actually be a lesser evil, at least from the Russian point of view, because as you said, Russia indeed does not want to see NATO in Ukraine. Now, can I ask you about the European, specifically the EU position? What exactly the EU now wants to see in Ukraine? And I'm not asking you about best wishes. In the most practical terms, given the underlying causes of this conflict, what is the best possible scenario that the EU should be working toward?
I think I repeat, there's no real strategy of the European Union in Ukraine. There's a lot of different opinions within the European Union by the member states, for sure, which is quite okay that it is happening. And I think sometimes the reactions are really too primitive. I understand, I'm not happy about, but I understand this frozen conflict strategy of Putin, because it's giving possibility to influence the situation. Whenever he wants, he can open the conflict, he can close the conflict.
No, I don't think it's about opening or closing the conflict, but simply not letting NATO consume, in a strategic sense, consume Ukraine. But what I'm more interested in, again, is the European factor, because you remember people, when they took to the streets, they were chanting Ukraine is Europe. And what they meant by that is the European Union. Do they have any chance of realizing that European dream at this point?
I think you have to understand that for a very long time, and that I think even it's still now existing, there is, an understanding Europe is European Union, which is not right. Because not whole Europe is European Union, for sure, that's quite clear. But that is the impression. And I think you should also understand the alternative of the countries coming out of the Soviet Empire by the downbreak of the Iron Curtain. I think their perspective was European Union. I think we want to go immediately to the European Union.
And I can tell you for sure that this was exactly what the Ukrainians had on their mind. Not the European culture, not the European music, but the European Union, the European standards of living, European right. institutions, and so on and so forth. And at that time, I think the leadership of the European Commission was encouraging that sentiment. Has
but
it delivered
never
on that?
Never giving a promise that the Ukraine might become a member of the European Union. I think that was never promised.
Was it? Because I think many Ukrainians took it exactly like that.
That was never promised. There's no decision within the European Union that Ukraine might become member of the European Union. I think this is misunderstood or sometimes misused also by the understanding on the Russian side. I think he has no decision ever done. It is always a phrase used, neighborhood policy. We need the European Union neighborhood policy.
Dr. Busek, is that really fair? Because you know that in order to make that civilizational choice, as the Ukrainian politicians like to call it, they had to sever many of their economic ties with Russia. Many of the industrial ties were cut. Ukraine is now risking losing income from the gas transit. So Ukraine has made a lot of sacrifices for what? If it cut its ties with Russia, it surely hoped that it would be embraced by the West more fully, not just encouraged, but fully embraced and supported.
It is right if the Ukrainians want to have the perspective of the European Union, but this is not going from one day to the other. I think that's always misunderstood. You can become, with one switch, member of the European Union. You have to fulfill the conditions and there are a lot of consequences you have already mentioned here that need some time. You may write in these critiques that the representatives of the European Union were not rightly outspoken on this subject. I think they never contradicted to these hopes, but they were never delivering any decision opening this possibility. Personally, I'm convinced it might be right after 20, 30 years. I think you need some time to consume the results of history and. I think you cannot develop a common Europe within one switch and in a short time. I think it needs some time. We were proposing on the Austrian side several times to the Ukrainians they might declare neutrality, because we Austrians, we have a good experience also towards the Soviet Union in previous time. And here I learned that the Ukrainians were not really understanding this strategy, declaring neutrality.
Well, Dr. Busek, let me stop you right here. We have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome back to World Apart with Dr. Erhard Busek, former Vice Chancellor of Austria. Dr. Busek, just before the break, you mentioned Austria's neutral status, and there was a time when Ukraine also enjoyed that status and was quite content with it. Unfortunately, that's no longer the case. According to polls, the majority of Ukrainians now strongly favor joining of NATO. And that may be Russia's fault. That may have been provoked by Russia's own policy. But the thing is, it seems that NATO is not ready or willing to reciprocate, not only because of the fears of provoking Russia, but frankly because of Ukraine's own internal security and economic risks. What kind of a relationship do you think the West can now realistically offer to Ukraine as far as integration or security matters go?
Again, I'm repeating what I've said. There's no real strategy concerning Ukraine within the European Union.
So nothing, just the abstract discussion about the values, but nothing in concrete.
Nothing in concrete. I think there was never done a real decision what to offer Ukraine. But what is really more important, and we have always to look, there is a part of members in the European Union saying, we cannot offer a strategy to the Ukrainians because Russia does not want it. That plays a very important role for some who are very cautious on this subject. I'm not quite sure that there was really a precise discussion with the Russians how to manage the problem.
Well, I totally agree with you. Moreover, I think Russians really feel the need now to put the rest, put their conflict with Ukraine to rest, and hopefully have Europe or the European Union take some responsibility for what transpired in that country, because Ukraine is in a difficult financial position now. It needs some sources of income, and it's not quite obvious how it can substitute for the lost income from the severe economic ties with Russia. Do you think the association agreement that was, again, the sort of the beginning point for this conflict,
difficulties?
Do you think it provides enough for Ukraine to carry on?
I think association agreement is not enough. I think there are also necessary changes within the Ukraine, concerning how economy is done, legislation and so on. And, there are a lot of hints and also proposals by the European Union what should change. The real problem internally in the Ukrainian is the decision-making on this subject. There are a lot of differences, not only between West and East here in this context, also in which strategy it can be really done. I think it's a question of political management here. Ukraine has to learn to be independent because they have been for a very long time part of the Soviet Empire.
But isn't that a little bit cruel? I mean, Ukraine was, it had some sort of a symbiotic relationship with Russia. That relationship was cut very dramatically on the pretext that, you know, Ukraine should aspire to brighter Western values. And now people in the West are telling Ukraine, come on, you are on your own. We support you, but you are really on your own, despite the fact that it has a very difficult situation, not only with Russia, but also with other neighbors, because it does not want to be part of the customs union, which complicates its trade with other countries of the former Soviet Union. Is that really fair? Is that a fair position?
My dear, this is a problem of such tremendous changes. I think to leave the Soviet Empire from one day to the other does not mean that you are able to handle the things on your own way. I think here you need steps and bitter experiences. Even if you see the reunification of the both Germanies has still consequences and difficulties internally, which are not yet done. And even concerning Ukraine, it's even more important because here the cuts are for sure even more important. Also concerning the specific energy situation, but not only on this. Mm-hmm. I think you can see Crimea, okay, now taken by the Russians, but it is also a problem for the Russians and it costs a lot of money.
Well, it costs a lot of money, but I think that I know that you believe that Crimea is not a finished issue, and I actually believe with you, agree with you on that. I think there will come a time when Russia will make an accommodation to Ukraine on the issue of Crimea, not necessarily changing the borders, but I'm pretty sure that Russia will, at some point of time, make sure that Ukrainians feel very welcome in Crimea. This is the only way for Russia to patch its difficulties with Ukraine.
You are really right.
Now, you mentioned the energy issue, and this is very interesting because 3 years ago we heard about the unified Western position on Ukraine, but now it's not even clear what the West really means. Take, for example, the second Nord Stream pipeline. We have the Americans who are strongly against it. We have the Germans and the Austrians who are for it. Do they even have the Ukrainian interest, any one of them? Do they have the Ukrainian interest in mind? Because there seems to be that each country is pursuing their own economic...
My dear, I have to defend the Austrians. What we did is to do some changes concerning some pipelines that we are able to send energy, in this sense, oil or gas, even back to Ukraine. Here we did it, but we are playing a minor role on this. I think the whole situation is under tremendous changes, and for sure, the real background is, I think we need a certain way of regulation in the relations between Russia on the one side and the European Union on the other side. I think the energy problem you have to see in a global context even. And I think there are not enough talks on both sides in this direction.
But when you specifically consider that issue of gas transit, on the one hand, Ukraine needs that kind of income from gas transit. On the other hand, you don't want to be worrying about the supply of gas every winter. Who do you think and how do you think that decision should be made, whether or not that project should be given a green light if you put Ukraine at the center of all of this?
I think it cannot be done only by the Ukraine, and I think we need a general arrangement, which is obviously extremely difficult because all the arrangements, looking for example to the Minsk agreement, it does not really work because it's not really fulfilled under all conditions. This is a very good example because I think it's even more urgent than the energy question because here we need peace and such a high number of victims still existing. Mm-hmm. I think here we need another behavior concerning negotiations and how they are really fulfilled. I think the talks should be quite more open and straight to the subject.
Well, Americans seem to be playing a very active role, and there seems to be some progress as far as the American representative on Ukraine is concerned. He's trying to get some deal on the UN peacekeeping force, and I think Russia would generally be in favor of that. But the problem is again whether the Ukrainian side will be able to cooperate, because politically its options are very limited.
They have to fulfill some conditions internally, and I think here I may say on the side of the European Union, we have to have more talks with the Ukrainian concerning fulfillment. There are also different positions within Ukraine on the subject. I have quite a good knowledge about the Western Ukraine, or former Galicia, if we may say. Here the positions are quite different as to the East, and sometimes it is more not a principal position, but that some politicians might lose respect because they have promised things which are not very realistic and so on and so on. There's too much politics in a bad way on this way.
Now, I think it's indisputable that what Ukrainians wanted during the Maidan protests was the change of formation, the change of economic and governing model. And I think it would be fair to say that so far they only got the change of leadership. It's the governing model has not yet fully been transformed. But I know there are lots of people in Russia who would eagerly blame Poroshenko for that. But if we are really fair, it is a major problem for all post-communist societies. It's extremely difficult to grow your institutions. I know that you have a special expertise in that area. Do we understand at this point of time what it takes to move from post-authoritarian, post-communist societies into a stronger democratic ones?
It is a learning process and you need efforts, I think, that you are willing to learn. And here's a difficulty by acting politicians and by political strategists and so on and so on, because a lot of countries are using the difficulties for their own purpose internally and so on and so on. I think some parties are really living out of this and raising some question. I think if one neighboring country is saying, oh, it's nice, give us back the Carpato Ukraine for Hungary, it's not helpful. I think so far, I think we have to put out some other questions and really be concerned to move on. For sure, there are tremendous changes within Ukraine necessary to develop more democracy. But I want to be fair, that needs a lot of time and experience, and it needs a lot of training. So far, I'm very much looking always to education.
There are some other examples in Eastern Europe that many in Western Europe are somewhat concerned about. I'm in Hungary, I'm in Poland. Those countries are sometimes accused of being increasingly authoritarian. Do you see that in the same light, that they are sort of going back in history, returning to the most authoritarian instincts? Or is it just a normal learning curve? Sometimes you go forward, sometimes you relapse. Is that part of growing that democratic muscle, or is that already something to be worried about?
I think here I want to be quite outspoken. This judgment which is happening in Hungary and on Poland and so on is a pure nonsense. I think it's mixed up with history. In one point, Viktor Orban is totally right. I think communism in Hungary was not really changed, or there was no learning curve on this, moving out of this. They switched from communistic state to democracy immediately. I think even it was very nice that the new government, which was an old communist government in Hungary, put down their party books and the problem was finished. It's not yet finished. I think you need some time to consume and to get step by step other.
Well, you certainly cannot change societies by political declarations. And I think there are lots of studies these days about values in many post-communist societies. And you see a very significant change on many social issues like the LGBT, migration, abortion, and many similar issues. There is a divide between Western Europe and Eastern Europe. And up until recently, I think the position of the Western Europe has been that you guys have to play by, you know, you have to be like us, you have to accept our values, and that's pretty much it. Don't you think that what we are seeing in Poland, in Hungary, maybe even in Russia, is a sort of a pushback against this kind of moralistic supremacy?
Yeah, you are totally right. I think the strategy which was done, you have to change from one day to the other, is a pure nonsense. You need some time and you need a specific kind of dialogue. I would even say empathy to have an understanding, which is partly missing. I'm working on this subject for a very long time and I'm preaching it in my own country and also in Western European countries. That they need another perception of consuming history and consequences out of this, for sure. It is a learning process, which may are making it difficult. It hurts sometimes, without any doubt. But I think there's also necessary quite patience. I'm missing, for example, even by my own country or by the government of my country, a certain kind of dialogue. I think we had better times after the downfall of the Iron Curtain with our neighboring countries as we have nowadays, because I think we are doing so that we know everything and they are wrong. I think this is wrong. I think you have to understand why they are doing so and start a discussion on the subject where might be some mistakes and which steps you can do and so on.
Well, Dr. Busek, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time. And to our viewers, please share your comments on our Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube pages. And I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.